ambigram, ambi meaning both, signifying it was legible both ways. And although ambigrams were common in symbology, swastikas, yin-yang, Jewish stars, simple crosses, the idea that a word could be crafted into an ambigram seemed utterly impossible. Modern symbologists had tried for years to forge the word Illuminati into a perfectly symmetrical style, but they had failed miserably. Most academics had now decided the symbol's existence was a myth. "So, who are the Illuminati?" Kohler demanded. Yes, Langdon thought. Who, indeed? He began his tale. "Since the beginning of history," Langdon explained, "a deep rift has existed between science and religion. Outspoken scientists like Copernicus were murdered," Kohler interjected. "Murdered by the church for revealing scientific truths. Religion has always persecuted science." "Yes. But in the 1500s, a group of men in Rome fought back against the church. Some of Italy's most enlightened men, physicists, mathematicians, astronomers, began meeting secretly to share their concerns about the church's inaccurate teachings. They feared that the church's monopoly on truth threatened academic enlightenment around the world. They founded the world's first scientific think tank, calling themselves the Enlightened Ones."
"The Illuminati?"
"Yes," Langdon said. "Europe's most learned minds dedicated to the quest for scientific truth." Kohler fell silent. "Of course, the Illuminati were hunted ruthlessly by the Catholic Church. Only through rites of extreme secrecy did the scientists remain safe. Word spread through the academic underground, and the Illuminati Brotherhood grew to include academics from all over Europe. The scientists met regularly in Rome at an ultra-secret lair they called the Church of Illumination." Kohler coughed and shifted in his chair. "Many of the Illuminati," Langdon continued, "wanted to combat the church's tyranny with acts of violence, but their most revered member persuaded them against it. He was a pacifist as well as one of history's most famous scientists." Langdon was certain Kohler would recognize the name. Even non-scientists were familiar with the ill-fated astronomer who had been arrested and almost executed by the church for proclaiming that the sun and not the earth was the center of the solar system. Although his data were incontrovertible, the astronomer was severely punished for implying that God had placed mankind somewhere other than at the center of his universe. "His name was Galileo Galilei," Langdon said. Kohler looked up.
"Galileo?"
"Yes. Galileo was an Illuminatus. And he was also a devout Catholic. He tried to soften the church's position on science by proclaiming that science did not undermine the existence of God, but rather reinforced it. He wrote once that when he looked through his telescope at the spinning planets, he could hear God's voice in the music of the spheres. He held that science and religion were not enemies, but rather allies, two different languages telling the same story, a story of symmetry and balance. Heaven and hell, night and day, hot and cold, God and Satan. Both science and religion rejoiced in God's symmetry. The endless contest of light and dark." Langdon paused, stamping his feet to stay warm. Kohler simply sat in his wheelchair and stared. "Unfortunately," Langdon added, "the unification of science and religion was not what the church wanted."
"Of course not," Kohler interrupted. "The union would have nullified the church's claim as the sole vessel through which men could understand God. So the church tried Galileo as a heretic, found him guilty, and put him under permanent house arrest. I'm quite aware of scientific history, Mr. Langdon. But this was all centuries ago. What does it have to do with Leonardo Vetra?"
"The million-dollar question." Langdon cut to the chase. "Galileo's arrest threw the Illuminati into upheaval. Mistakes were made, and the church discovered the identities of four members, whom they captured and interrogated. But the four scientists revealed nothing, even under torture.
Torture?
Langdon nodded. They were branded alive, on the chest, with the symbol of the cross. Kohler's eyes widened, and he shot an uneasy glance at Vatra's body. Then the scientists were brutally murdered. Their dead bodies dropped in the streets of Rome as a warning to others thinking of joining the Illuminati. With the church closing in, the remaining Illuminati fled Italy. Langdon paused to make his point. He looked directly into Kohler's dead eyes. The Illuminati went deep underground, where they began mixing with other refugee groups fleeing the Catholic purges. Mystics, alchemists, occultists, Muslims, Jews. Over the years, the Illuminati began absorbing new members. A new Illuminati emerged, a darker Illuminati, a deeply anti-Christian Illuminati. They grew very powerful, employing mysterious rites, deadly secrecy, vowing someday to rise again and take revenge on the Catholic Church. Their power grew to the point where the Church considered them the single most dangerous anti-Christian force on earth. The Vatican denounced the Brotherhood as Shaitan.
Shaitan.
It's Islamic. It means adversary. God's adversary. The Church chose Islam for the name because it was a language they considered dirty. Langdon hesitated.
Shaitan is the root of an English word. Satan.
An uneasiness crossed Kohler's face. Langdon's voice was grim. Mr. Kohler, I don't know how this marking appeared on this man's chest, or why, but you are looking at the long-lost symbol of the world's oldest and most powerful satanic cult. Chapter 10. The alley was narrow and deserted. The Hashashin strode quickly now, his black eyes filling with anticipation. As he approached his destination, Janus's parting words echoed in his mind. Phase 2 begins shortly. Get some rest. The Hashashin smirked. He had been awake all night, but sleep was the last thing on his mind. Sleep was for the weak. He was a warrior like his ancestors before him, and his people never slept once a battle had begun. This battle had most definitely begun, and he had been given the honor of spilling first blood. Now he had 2 hours to celebrate his glory before going back to work. Sleep? There are far better ways to relax. An appetite for hedonistic pleasure was something bred into him by his ancestors. His ascendants had indulged in hashish, but he preferred a different kind of gratification. He took pride in his body, a well-tuned, lethal machine, which, despite his heritage, he refused to pollute with narcotics. He had developed a more nourishing addiction than drugs, a far more healthy and satisfying reward. Feeling a familiar anticipation swelling within him, the Hashashin moved faster down the alley. He arrived at the nondescript door and rang the bell. A view slit in the door opened, and 2 soft brown eyes studied him appraisingly. Then the door swung open.
Welcome,
the well-dressed woman said. She ushered him into an impeccably furnished sitting room where the lights were low. The air was laced with expensive perfume and musk.
Whenever you are ready.
She handed him a book of photographs.
Ring me when you have made your choice.
Then she disappeared. The Hashashin smiled. As he sat on the plush divan and positioned the photo album on his lap, he felt a carnal hunger stir. Although his people did not celebrate Christmas, he imagined that this was what it must feel like to be a Christian child, sitting before a stack of Christmas presents, about to discover the miracles inside. He opened the album and examined the photos. A lifetime of sexual fantasies stared back at him. Marisa, an Italian goddess, fiery, a young Sophia Loren. Sachiko, a Japanese geisha, lithe, no doubt skilled. Kanara, a stunning black vision, muscular, exotic. He examined the entire album twice and made his choice. He pressed a button on the table beside him. A minute later, the woman who had greeted him reappeared. He indicated his selection. She smiled. Follow me. After handling the financial arrangements, the woman made a hushed phone call. She waited a few minutes and then led him up a winding marble staircase to a luxurious hallway. It's the gold door on the end, she said. You have expensive taste. I should, he thought. I am a connoisseur. The Hashashin padded the length of the hallway like a panther anticipating a long overdue meal. When he reached the doorway, he smiled to himself. It was already ajar, welcoming him in. He pushed, and the door swung noiselessly open. When he saw his selection, he knew he had chosen well. She was exactly as he had requested. Nude, lying on her back, her arms tied to the bedposts with thick velvet cords. He crossed the room and ran a dark finger across her ivory abdomen. I killed last night, he thought. You are my reward. Chapter 11. Satanic. Kohler wiped his mouth and shifted uncomfortably. This is the symbol of a satanic cult? Langdon paced the frozen room to keep warm. The Illuminati were satanic, but not in the modern sense. Langdon quickly explained how most people pictured satanic cults as devil-worshipping fiends. And yet Satanists historically were educated men who stood as adversaries to the church. Shaitan. The rumors of satanic black magic animal sacrifices and the pentagram ritual were nothing but lies spread by the church as a smear campaign against their adversaries. Over time, opponents of the church, wanting to emulate the Illuminati, began believing the lies and acting them out. Thus, modern Satanism was born. Kohler grunted abruptly. This is all ancient history. I want to know how this symbol got here. Langdon took a deep breath. The symbol itself was created by an anonymous 16th century Illuminati artist as a tribute to Galileo's love of symmetry, a kind of sacred Illuminati logo. The Brotherhood kept the design secret, allegedly planning to reveal it only when they had amassed enough power to resurface and carry out their final goal. Kohler looked unsettled. So this symbol means the Illuminati Brotherhood is resurfacing? Langdon frowned. That would be impossible. There is one chapter of Illuminati history that I have not yet explained. Kohler's voice intensified. Enlighten me. Langdon rubbed his palms together, mentally sorting through the hundreds of documents he'd read or written on the Illuminati. The Illuminati were survivors, he explained. When they fled Rome, they traveled across Europe looking for a safe place to regroup. They were taken in by another secret society, a brotherhood of wealthy Bavarian stone craftsmen called the Freemasons. Kohler looked startled. The Masons? Langdon nodded, not at all surprised that Kohler had heard of the group. The Brotherhood of the Masons currently had over 5 million members worldwide. Half of them residing in the United States, and over 1 million of them in Europe. Certainly the Masons are not satanic, Kohler declared, sounding suddenly skeptical. Absolutely not. The Masons fell victim to their own benevolence. After harboring the fleeing scientists in the 1700s, the Masons unknowingly became a front for the Illuminati. The Illuminati grew within their ranks, gradually taking over positions of power within the lodges. They quietly re-established their scientific brotherhood deep within the Masons, a kind of secret society within a secret society. Then the Illuminati used the worldwide connection of Masonic lodges to spread their influence. Langdon drew a cold breath before racing on. Obliteration of Catholicism was the Illuminati's central covenant. The Brotherhood held that the superstitious dogma spewed forth by the Church was mankind's greatest enemy. They feared that if religion continued to promote pious myth as absolute fact, scientific progress would halt, and mankind would be doomed to an ignorant future of senseless holy wars. Much like we see today. Langdon frowned. Kohler was right. Holy wars were still making headlines. My God is better than your God. It seemed that there was always close correlation between true believers and high body counts. Go on, Kohler said. Langdon gathered his thoughts and continued. The Illuminati grew more powerful in Europe and set their sights on America, a fledgling government many of whose leaders were Masons. George Washington, Ben Franklin, honest, God-fearing men who were unaware of the Illuminati's stronghold on the Masons. The Illuminati took advantage of the infiltration and helped found banks, universities, and industry to finance their ultimate quest. Langdon paused. The creation of a single, unified world state. A kind of secular new world order. Kohler didn't move. A new world order, Langdon repeated, based on scientific enlightenment. They called it their Luciferian doctrine. The Church claimed Lucifer was a reference to the devil, but the Brotherhood insisted Lucifer was intended in its literal Latin meaning, bringer of light, or illuminator. Kohler sighed, and his voice grew suddenly solemn. Mr. Langdon, please sit down. Langdon sat tentatively on a frost-covered chair. Kohler moved his wheelchair closer. I am not sure I understand everything you have just told me, but I do understand this. Leonardo Vitra was one of CERN's greatest assets. He was also a friend. I need you to help me locate the Illuminati. Langdon didn't know how to respond. Locate the Illuminati? He's kidding, right? I'm afraid, sir, that will be utterly impossible. Kohler's brow creased. What do you mean? You won't... Mr. Kohler. Langdon leaned toward his host, uncertain how to make him understand what he was about to say. I didn't finish my story. Despite appearances, it is extremely unlikely that this brand was put here by the Illuminati. There has been no evidence of their existence for over half a century. And most scholars agree the Illuminati have been defunct for many years. The words hit silence. Kohler stared through the fog with a look somewhere between stupefaction and anger. How the hell can you tell me this group is extinct when their name is seared into this man? Langdon had been asking himself that question all morning. The appearance of the Illuminati ambigram was astonishing. Symbologists worldwide would be dazzled. And yet, the academic in Langdon understood that the brand's reemergence proved absolutely nothing about the Illuminati. Symbols, Langdon said, in no way confirm the presence of their original creators. What is that supposed to mean? It means that when organized philosophies like the Illuminati go out of existence, their symbols remain, available for adoption by other groups. It's called transference. It's very common in symbology. The Nazis took the swastika from the Hindus. The Christians adopted the cruciform from the Egyptians. This morning, Kohler challenged,
When I typed the word Illuminati into the computer, it returned thousands of current references. Apparently, a lot of people think this group is still active.
Conspiracy buffs, Langdon replied. He had always been annoyed by the plethora of conspiracy theories that circulated in modern pop culture. The media craved apocalyptic headlines, and self-proclaimed cult specialists were still cashing in on millennium hype with fabricated stories that the Illuminati were alive and well and organizing their new world order. Recently, the New York Times had reported the eerie Masonic ties of countless famous men. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the Duke of Kent, Peter Sellers, Irving Berlin, Prince Philip, Louis Armstrong. As well as a pantheon of well-known modern-day industrialists and banking magnates. Kohler pointed angrily at Vatra's body.
Considering the evidence, I would say perhaps the conspiracy buffs are correct.
I realize how it appears, Langdon said as diplomatically as he could. And yet a far more plausible explanation is that some other organization has taken control of the Illuminati brand and is using it for their own purposes.
What purposes? What does this murder prove?
Good question, Langdon thought. He also was having trouble imagining where anyone could have turned up the Illuminati brand after 400 years. All I can tell you is that even if the Illuminati were still active today, which I am virtually positive they aren't, they would never be involved in Leonardo Vetra's death.
No?
No. The Illuminati may have believed in the abolition of Christianity, but they wielded their power through political and financial means, not through terrorist acts. Furthermore, the Illuminati had a strict code of morality regarding who they saw as enemies. They held men of science in the highest regard. There is no way they would have murdered a fellow scientist like Leonardo Vetra. Kohler's eyes turned to ice.
Perhaps I failed to mention that Leonardo Vetra was anything but an ordinary scientist.
Langdon exhaled patiently. Mr. Kohler, I'm sure Leonardo Vetra was brilliant in many ways, but the fact remains. Without warning, Kohler spun in his wheelchair and accelerated out of the living room, leaving a wake of swirling mist as he disappeared down a hallway.
For the love of God, Langdon groaned.
He followed. Kohler was waiting for him in a small alcove at the end of the hallway.
This is Leonardo's study, Kohler said,
motioning to the sliding door.
Perhaps when you see it, you'll understand things differently.
With an awkward grunt, Kohler heaved and the door slid open. Langdon peered into the study and immediately felt his skin crawl. Holy Mother of Jesus, he said to himself. Chapter 12. In another country, a young guard sat patiently before an expansive bank of video monitors. He watched as images flashed before him, live feeds from hundreds of wireless video cameras that surveyed the sprawling complex. The images went by in an endless procession. An ornate hallway, a private office, an industrial-sized kitchen. As the pictures went by, the guard fought off a daydream. He was nearing the end of his shift, and yet he was still vigilant. Service was an honor. Someday he would be granted his ultimate reward. As his thoughts drifted, an image before him registered alarm. Suddenly, with a reflexive jerk that startled even himself, his hand shot out and hit a button on the control panel. The picture before him froze. His nerves tingling, he leaned toward the screen for a closer look. The reading on the monitor told him the image was being transmitted from camera number 86, a camera that was supposed to be overlooking a hallway. But the image before him was most definitely not a hallway. Chapter 13. Langdon stared in bewilderment at the study before him.
What is this place?
Despite the welcome blast of warm air on his face, he stepped through the door with trepidation. Kohler said nothing as he followed Langdon inside. Langdon scanned the room, not having the slightest idea what to make of it. It contained the most peculiar mix of artifacts he had ever seen. On the far wall, dominating the decor, was an enormous wooden crucifix, which Langdon placed as 14th century Spanish. Above the cruciform, suspended from the ceiling, was a metallic mobile of the orbiting planets. To the left was an oil painting of the Virgin Mary, and beside that was a laminated periodic table of elements. On the side wall, two additional brass cruciforms flanked a poster of Albert Einstein, his famous quote reading, "God does not play dice with the universe." Langdon moved into the room, looking around in astonishment. A leather-bound Bible sat on Vetra's desk beside a plastic Bohr model of an atom and a miniature replica of Michelangelo's Moses. Talk about eclectic, Langdon thought. The warmth felt good, but something about the decor sent a new set of chills through his body. He felt like he was witnessing the clash of two philosophical titans, an unsettling blur of opposing forces. He scanned the titles on the bookshelf. The God Particle. The Tao of Physics. God, the Evidence. One of the bookends was etched with a quote, "True science discovers God waiting behind every door. Pope Pius XII." "Leonardo was a Catholic priest," Kohler said. Langdon turned. "A priest? I thought you said he was a physicist."
"He was both. Men of science and religion are not unprecedented in history. Leonardo was one of them. He considered physics God's natural law. He claimed God's handwriting was visible in the natural order all around us. Through science, he hoped to prove God's existence to the doubting masses. He considered himself a theophysicist."
Theophysicist? Langdon thought it sounded impossibly oxymoronic.
"The field of particle physics," Kohler said, "has made some shocking discoveries lately. Discoveries quite spiritual in implication. Leonardo was responsible for many of them."
Langdon studied CERN's director, still trying to process the bizarre surroundings.
Spirituality and physics?
Langdon had spent his career studying religious history, and if there was one recurring theme, it was that science and religion had been oil and water since day one. Arch enemies, unmixable.
"Vetra was on the cutting edge of particle physics," Kohler said. "He was starting to fuse science and religion, showing that they complement each other in most unanticipated ways. He called the field New Physics."
Kohler pulled a book from the shelf and handed it to Langdon. Langdon studied the cover. "God, Miracles, and the New Physics" by Leonardo Vetra.
"The field is small," Kohler said, "but it's bringing fresh answers to some old questions. Questions about the origin of the universe and the forces that bind us all. Leonardo believed his research had the potential to convert millions to a more spiritual life. Last year, he categorically proved the existence of an energy force that unites us all. He actually demonstrated that we are all physically connected, that the molecules in your body are intertwined with the molecules in mine, that there is a single force moving within all of us."
Langdon felt disconcerted. "And the power of God shall unite us all."
"Mr. Vetra actually found a way to demonstrate that particles are connected?" "Conclusive evidence. A recent Scientific American article hailed New Physics as a surer path to God than religion itself."
The comment hit home. Langdon suddenly found himself thinking of the anti-religious Illuminati. Reluctantly, he forced himself to permit a momentary intellectual foray into the impossible. If the Illuminati were indeed still active, Would they have killed Leonardo to stop him from bringing his religious message to the masses? Langdon shook off the thought. Absurd. The Illuminati are ancient history. All academics know that. Vetra had plenty of enemies in the scientific world, Kohler went on. Many scientific purists despised him, even here at CERN. They felt that using analytical physics to support religious principles was a treason against science. But aren't scientists today a bit less defensive about the church? Kohler grunted in disgust. Why should we be? The church may not be burning scientists at the stake anymore. But if you think they've released their reign over science, ask yourself why half the schools in your country are not allowed to teach evolution. Ask yourself why the U.S. Christian Coalition is the most influential lobby against scientific progress in the world. The battle between science and religion is still raging, Mr. Langdon. It has moved from the battlefields to the boardrooms, but it is still raging. Langdon realized Kohler was right. Just last week, the Harvard School of Divinity had marched on the biology building, protesting the genetic engineering taking place in the graduate program. The chairman of the bio department, famed ornithologist Richard Aronian, defended his curriculum by hanging a huge banner from his office window. The banner depicted the Christian fish, modified with four little feet, a tribute, Aronian claimed, to the African lungfish's evolution onto dry land. Beneath the fish, instead of the word Jesus, was the proclamation Darwin. A sharp beeping sound cut the air, and Langdon looked up. Kohler reached down into the array of electronics on his wheelchair. He slipped a beeper out of its holder and read the incoming message.
Good. That is Leonardo's daughter. Miss Vetra is arriving at the helipad right now. We will meet her there. I think at best she not come up and see her father this way.
Langdon agreed. It would be a shock no child deserved.
I will ask Miss Vetra to explain the project she and her father have been working on, perhaps shedding light on why he was murdered.
You think Vetra's work is why he was killed?
Quite possibly. Leonardo told me he was working on something groundbreaking. That is all he said. He had become very secretive about the project. He had a private lab and demanded seclusion, which I gladly afforded him on account of his brilliance. His work had been consuming huge amounts of electric power lately, but I refrained from questioning him.
Kohler rotated toward the study door.
There is, however, one more thing you need to know before we leave this flat.
Langdon was not sure he wanted to hear it.
An item was stolen from Vetra by his murderer.
An item?
Follow me.
The director propelled his wheelchair back into the fog-filled living room. Langdon followed, not knowing what to expect. Kohler maneuvered to within inches of Vetra's body and stopped. He ushered Langdon to join him. Reluctantly, Langdon came close, bile rising in his throat at the smell of the victim's frozen urine.
Look at his face, Kohler said.
Look at his face, Langdon frowned. I thought you said something was stolen. Hesitantly, Langdon knelt down. He tried to see Vetra's face, but the head was twisted 180 degrees backward, his face pressed into the carpet. Struggling against his handicap, Kohler reached down and carefully twisted Vetra's frozen head. Cracking loudly, the corpse's face rotated into view, contorted in agony. Kohler held it there a moment.
Sweet Jesus!
Langdon cried, stumbling back in horror. Vetra's face was covered in blood. A single hazel eye stared lifelessly back at him. The other socket was tattered and empty.
They stole his eye?
Chapter 14. Langdon stepped out of Building C into the open air, grateful to be outside Vetra's flat. The sun helped dissolve the image of the empty eye socket emblazoned into his mind.
"This way, please," Kohler said, veering up a steep path. The electric wheelchair seemed to accelerate effortlessly. "Miss Vetra will be arriving any moment."
Langdon hurried to keep up.
"So," Kohler asked, "do you still doubt the Illuminati's involvement?"
Langdon had no idea what to think anymore. Vetra's religious affiliations were definitely troubling, and yet Langdon could not bring himself to abandon every shred of academic evidence he had ever researched. Besides, there was the eye.
"I still maintain," Langdon said more forcefully than he intended, "that the Illuminati were not responsible for this murder. The missing eye is proof."
"What?"
"Random mutilation," Langdon explained, "is very un-Illuminati. Cult specialists see desultory defacement from inexperienced fringe sects. Zealots who commit random acts of terrorism, but the Illuminati have always been more deliberate."
"Deliberate? Surgically removing someone's eyeball is not deliberate?"
"It sends no clear message. It serves no higher purpose."
Kohler's wheelchair stopped short at the top of the hill. He turned.
"Mr. Langdon, believe me, that missing eye does indeed serve a higher purpose. A much higher purpose."
As the two men crossed the grassy rise, the beating of helicopter blades became audible to the west. A chopper appeared, arching across the open valley toward them. It banked sharply, then slowed to a hover over a helipad painted on the grass. Langdon watched, detached, his mind churning circles like the blades, wondering if a full night's sleep would make his current disorientation any clearer. Somehow he doubted it. As the skids touched down, a pilot jumped out and started unloading gear. There was a lot of it, duffels, vinyl wet bags, scuba tanks, and crates of what appeared to be high-tech diving equipment. Langdon was confused.
"Is that Miss Vetra's gear?"
he yelled to Kohler over the roar of the engines. Kohler nodded and yelled back.
"She was doing biological research in the Balearic Sea."
"I thought you said she was a physicist."
"She is. She's a bio-entanglement physicist. She studies the interconnectivity of life systems. Her work ties closely with her father's work in particle physics. Recently she disproved one of Einstein's fundamental theories by using atomically synchronized cameras to observe a school of tuna fish."
Langdon searched his host's face for any glint of humor. Einstein and tuna fish? He was starting to wonder if the X-33 space plane had mistakenly dropped him off on the wrong planet. A moment later, Vittoria Vetra emerged from the fuselage. Robert Langdon realized today was going to be a day of endless surprises. Descending from the chopper in her khaki shorts and white sleeveless top, Vittoria Vetra looked nothing like the bookish physicist he had expected. Lithe and graceful, she was tall, with chestnut skin and long black hair that swirled in the back wind of the rotors. Her face was unmistakably Italian, not overly beautiful, but possessing full, earthy features that even at 20 yards seemed to exude a raw sensuality. As the air currents buffeted her body, her clothes clung, accentuating her slender torso and small breasts.
"Miss Vetra is a woman of tremendous personal strength," Kohler said, seeming to sense Langdon's captivation. "She spends months at a time working in dangerous ecological systems. She is a strict vegetarian and CERN's resident guru of Hatha Yoga."
"Hatha Yoga?" Langdon mused. The ancient Buddhist art of meditative stretching seemed an odd proficiency for the physicist's daughter of a Catholic priest. Langdon watched Vittoria approach. She had obviously been crying, her deep sable eyes filled with emotions Langdon couldn't place. Still, she moved toward them with fire and command. Her limbs were strong and toned, radiating the healthy luminescence of Mediterranean flesh that had enjoyed long hours in the sun.
Vittoria, Kohler said as she approached, my deepest condolences. It's a terrible loss for science, for all of us here at CERN.
Vittoria nodded gratefully. When she spoke, her voice was smooth.
Do you know who's responsible yet?
We're still working on it.
She turned to Langdon, holding out a slender hand.
My name is Vittoria Vetra. You're from Interpol, I assume.
Langdon took her hand, momentarily spellbound by the depth of her watery gaze.
Robert Langdon.
He was unsure what else to say.
Mr. Langdon is not with the authorities, Kohler explained. He is a specialist from the U.S. He's here to help us locate who is responsible for this situation.
Vittoria looked uncertain.
And the police?
Kohler exhaled, but said nothing.
Where is his body? She demanded.
Being attended to.
The white lie surprised Langdon.
I want to see him, Vittoria said.
Vittoria, Kohler urged, your father was brutally murdered. You would be better to remember him as he was.
Vittoria began to speak, but was interrupted.
Hey, Vittoria!
Voices called from the distance.
Welcome home!
She turned. A group of scientists, passing near the helipad, waved happily.
Disprove any more of Einstein's theories? One shouted.
Another added, Your dad must be proud!
Vittoria gave the men an awkward wave as they passed. Then she turned to Kohler, her face now clouded with confusion.
Nobody knows yet?
I decided discretion was paramount.
You haven't told the staff my father was murdered?
Her mystified tone was now laced with anger.
Kohler's tone hardened instantly. Perhaps you forget, Miss Vetra. As soon as I report your father's murder, there will be an investigation of CERN, including a thorough examination of his lab. I have always tried to respect your father's privacy. Your father has told me only two things about your current project. One, that it has the potential to bring CERN millions of francs in licensing contracts in the next decade. And two, that it is not ready for public disclosure, because it is still hazardous technology. Considering these two facts, I would prefer strangers not poke around inside his lab and either steal his work or kill themselves in the process and hold CERN liable. Do I make myself clear?
Vittoria stared, saying nothing. Langdon sensed in her a reluctant respect and acceptance of Kohler's logic.
Before we report anything to the authorities, Kohler said, I need to know what you two were working on. I need you to take us to your lab.
The lab is irrelevant, Vittoria said. Nobody knew what my father and I were doing. The experiment could not possibly have anything to do with my father's murder.
Kohler exhaled a raspy, ailing breath.
Evidence suggests otherwise.
Evidence? What evidence?
Langdon was wondering the same thing.
Kohler was dabbing his mouth again. You'll just have to trust me.
It was clear from Vittoria's smoldering gaze that she didn't. Chapter 15. Langdon strode silently behind Vittoria and Kohler as they moved back into the main atrium where Langdon's bizarre visit had begun. Vittoria's legs drove in fluid efficiency, like an Olympic diver. A potency, Langdon figured, no doubt born from the flexibility and control of yoga. He could hear her breathing slowly and deliberately, as if somehow trying to filter her grief. Langdon wanted to say something to her, offer his sympathy. He too had once felt the abrupt hollowness of unexpectedly losing a parent. He remembered the funeral, mostly, rainy and gray, 2 days after his 12th birthday. The house was filled with gray-suited men from the office, men who squeezed his hand too hard when they shook it. They were all mumbling words like cardiac and stress. His mother joked through teary eyes that she'd always been able to follow the stock market simply by holding her husband's hand, his pulse, her own private ticker tape. Once, when his father was alive, Langdon had heard his mom begging his father to stop and smell the roses. That year, Langdon bought his father a tiny, blown-glass rose for Christmas. It was the most beautiful thing Langdon had ever seen, the way the sun caught it, throwing a rainbow of colors on the wall. "It's lovely," his father had said when he opened it, kissing Robert on the forehead. "Let's find a safe spot for it." Then his father had carefully placed the rose on a high, dusty shelf in the darkest corner of the living room. A few days later, Langdon got a stool, retrieved the rose, and took it back to the store. His father never noticed it was gone. The ping of an elevator pulled Langdon back to the present. Vittoria and Kohler were in front of him, boarding the lift. Langdon hesitated outside the open doors.
"Is something wrong?"
Kohler asked, sounding more impatient than concerned.
"Not at all," Langdon said, forcing himself toward the cramped carriage.
He only used elevators when absolutely necessary. He preferred the more open spaces of stairwells.
"Dr. Vetra's lab is subterranean," Kohler said.
"Wonderful," Langdon thought, as he stepped across the cleft, feeling an icy wind churn up from the depths of the shaft. The doors closed and the car began to descend.
"Six stories,"
Kohler said blankly, like an analytical engine. Langdon pictured the darkness of the empty shaft below them. He tried to block it out by staring at the numbered display of changing floors. Oddly, the elevator showed only two stops, ground level and LHC.
"What's LHC stand for?"
Langdon asked, trying not to sound nervous.
"Large Hadron Collider," Kohler said. "A particle accelerator."
Particle accelerator? Langdon was vaguely familiar with the term. He had first heard it over dinner with some colleagues at Dunster House in Cambridge. A physicist friend of theirs, Bob Brownell, had arrived for dinner one night in a rage.
"The bastards canceled it,"
Brownell cursed.
"Canceled what?" they all asked.
"The SSC."
"The what?"
"The superconducting supercollider."
Someone shrugged.
"I didn't know Harvard was building one."
"Not Harvard," he exclaimed. "The U.S. It was going to be the world's most powerful particle accelerator. One of the most important scientific projects of the century. $2 billion into it, and the Senate sacks the project. Damn Bible Belt lobbyists."
When Brownell finally calmed down, he explained that a particle accelerator was a large, circular tube through which subatomic particles were accelerated. Magnets in the tube turned on and off in rapid succession to push the particles around and around until they reached tremendous velocities. Fully accelerated particles circled the tube at over 180,000 miles per second.
"That's almost the speed of light," one of the professors exclaimed.
"Damn right," Brownell said.
He went on to say that by accelerating two particles in opposite directions around the tube and then colliding them, scientists could shatter the particles into their constituent parts and get a glimpse of nature's most fundamental components.
"Particle accelerators," Brownell declared, "are critical to the future of science. Colliding particles is the key to understanding the building blocks of the universe."
Harvard's poet-in-residence, a quiet man named Charles Pratt, didn't look impressed.
"It sounds to me," he said, "like a rather Neanderthal approach to science, akin to smashing clocks together to discern their internal workings."
Brownell dropped his fork and stormed out of the room. "So, CERN has a particle accelerator," Langdon thought, as the elevator dropped. "A circular tube for smashing particles." He wondered why they had buried it underground. When the elevator thumped to a stop, Langdon was relieved to feel terra firma beneath his feet. but when the doors slid open, his relief evaporated. Robert Langdon found himself standing once again in a totally alien world. The passageway stretched out indefinitely in both directions, left and right. It was a smooth cement tunnel, wide enough to allow passage of an 18-wheeler. Brightly lit where they stood, the corridor turned pitch black farther down. A damp wind rustled out of the darkness, an unsettling reminder that they were now deep in the earth. Langdon could almost sense the weight of the dirt and stone now hanging above his head. For an instant, he was 9 years old, the darkness forcing him back to the 5 hours of crushing blackness that haunted him still. Clenching his fists, he fought it off. Victoria remained hushed as she exited the elevator and strode off without hesitation into the darkness without them. Overhead, the fluorescence flickered on to light her path. The effect was unsettling, Langdon thought, as if the tunnel were alive, anticipating her every move. Langdon and Kohler followed, trailing a distance behind. The lights extinguished automatically behind them. "This particle accelerator," Langdon said quietly. "It's down this tunnel someplace?" "That's it there." Kohler motioned to his left, where a polished chrome tube ran along the tunnel's inner wall. Langdon eyed the tube, confused. "That's the accelerator?" The device looked nothing like he had imagined. It was perfectly straight, about 3 feet in diameter, and extended horizontally the visible length of the tunnel before disappearing into the darkness. "Looks more like a high-tech sewer," Langdon thought.
"I thought particle accelerators were circular." "This accelerator is a circle," Kohler said. "It appears straight, but that is an optical illusion. The circumference of this tunnel is so large that the curve is imperceptible, like that of the Earth." Langdon was flabbergasted.
"This is a circle? But it must be enormous."
"The LHC is the largest machine in the world."
Langdon did a double take. He remembered the CERN driver saying something about a huge machine buried in the earth. But
"It is over 8 kilometers in diameter and 27 kilometers long."
Langdon's head whipped around.
27 kilometers?
He stared at the director and then turned and looked into the darkened tunnel before him.
"This tunnel is 27 kilometers long? That's over 16 miles.
Kohler nodded.
"Bored in a perfect circle. It extends all the way into France before curving back here to this spot. Fully accelerated particles will circle the tube more than 10,000 times in a single second before they collide."
Langdon's legs felt rubbery as he stared down the gaping tunnel.
"You're telling me that CERN dug out millions of tons of Earth just to smash tiny particles?"
Kohler shrugged.
"Sometimes to find the truth, one must move mountains."
Chapter 16. Hundreds of miles from CERN, a voice crackled through a walkie-talkie.
"Okay, I'm in the hallway."
The technician monitoring the video screens pressed the button on his transmitter.
"You're looking for camera number 86. It's supposed to be at the far end."
There was a long silence on the radio. The waiting technician broke a light sweat. Finally, his radio clicked.
"The camera isn't here," the voice said. "I can see where it was mounted, though. Somebody must have removed it."
The technician exhaled heavily.
"Thanks. Hold on a second, will you?"
Sighing, he redirected his attention to the bank of video screens in front of him. Huge portions of the complex were open to the public, and wireless cameras had gone missing before, usually stolen by visiting pranksters looking for souvenirs. But as soon as a camera left the facility and was out of range, the signal was lost, and the screen went blank. Perplexed, the technician gazed up at the monitor. A crystal-clear image was still coming from camera number 86. If the camera was stolen, he wondered, why are we still getting a signal? He knew, of course, there was only one explanation. The camera was still inside the complex, and someone had simply moved it. But who? And why? He studied the monitor a long moment. Finally, he picked up his walkie-talkie. Are there any closets in that stairwell? Any cupboards or dark alcoves? The voice replying sounded confused. No, why? The technician frowned. Never mind. Thanks for your help. He turned off his walkie-talkie and pursed his lips. Considering the small size of the video camera and the fact that it was wireless, the technician knew that camera number 86 could be transmitting from just about anywhere within the heavily guarded compound. A densely packed collection of 32 separate buildings covering a half-mile radius. The only clue was that the camera seemed to have been placed somewhere dark. Of course, that wasn't much help. The complex contained endless dark locations, maintenance closets, heating ducts, gardening sheds, bedroom wardrobes, even a labyrinth of underground tunnels. Camera number 86 could take weeks to locate. But that's the least of my problems, he thought. Despite the dilemma posed by the camera's relocation, there was another far more unsettling matter at hand. The technician gazed up at the image the lost camera was transmitting. It was a stationary object, a modern-looking device like nothing the technician had ever seen. He studied the blinking electronic display at its base. Although the guard had undergone rigorous training, preparing him for tense situations, he still sensed his pulse rising. He told himself not to panic. There had to be an explanation. The object appeared too small to be of significant danger. Then again, its presence inside the complex was troubling. Very troubling, indeed. Today of all days, he thought. Security was always top priority for his employer, but today, more than any other day in the past 12 years, security was of the utmost importance. The technician stared at the object for a long time and sensed the rumblings of a distant gathering storm. Then, sweating, he dialed his superior. Chapter 17. Not many children could say they remembered the day they met their father, but Vittoria Vetra could. She was 8 years old, living where she always had, Orfano Trofio di Siena, a Catholic orphanage near Florence, deserted by parents she never knew. It was raining that day. The nuns had called for her twice to come to dinner, but as always she pretended not to hear. She lay outside in the courtyard, staring up at the raindrops, feeling them hit her body, trying to guess where one would land next. The nuns called again, threatening that pneumonia might make an insufferably headstrong child a lot less curious about nature. I can't hear you, Vittoria thought. She was soaked to the bone when the young priest came out to get her. She didn't know him. He was new there. Vittoria waited for him to grab her and drag her back inside, but he didn't. Instead, to her wonder, he lay down beside her, soaking his robes in a puddle. They say you ask a lot of questions, the young man said. Vittoria scowled. Were questions bad? He laughed. I guess they were right. What are you doing out here? Same thing you're doing. Wondering why raindrops fall. I'm not wondering why they fall. I already know. The priest gave her an astonished look. You do? Sister Francisca says raindrops are angels' tears coming down to wash away our sins. Wow, he said, sounding amazed. So that explains it. No, it doesn't, the girl fired back. Raindrops fall because everything falls. Everything falls, not just rain. The priest scratched his head, looking perplexed. You know, young lady, you're right. Everything does fall. It must be gravity. It must be what?
He gave her an astonished look. You haven't heard of gravity?
No.
The priest shrugged sadly. Too bad. Gravity answers a lot of questions. Vittoria sat up.
What's gravity?